This is community radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF. And now another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard.
This is Albert Big Man Howard. Back with you once again for Voices Behind the Walls here on KWTF Community Radio. And we will continue our reading of the author Marshall Eddy Conway, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. And we're going into chapter 8, and we will continue on. And we thank you for listening.
This is Marty McReynolds, continuing with Chapter 8 of Martial Law. The black Muslim newspaper Muhammad Speaks would come into the prison by the hundreds. The administration allowed it to be sold openly in the yard and anywhere else, but banned the black leftist papers. The Black Panther had to be smuggled into the prison and secretly passed from hand to hand. Any person caught with a copy would go on lockup for a long time. Once you put the two papers together, you could see right away the many differences between them. Both papers covered non-political issues in much the same manner and light. The real difference came into play when the issues were about the economy, race, or international affairs. Muhammad Speaks always assumed pro-capitalist positions, whether the story was about Africa or black folks in the U.S. Many of us felt that this paper seemed to be blaming the black community for economic injustice. We thought they were blaming the victim. The editors and writers at Muhammad Speaks often filtered the issues of race and racism through the framework of their religious beliefs. The old story of the white man as the devil and the black race as the chosen people was not enough to help folks develop a real analysis of the issues they were facing. The stories that covered the global situation had a slant from one of two possible perspectives: the economic structure of the country involved or the religion of the country involved. If the country was a capitalist nation or it was Islamic, it could do no wrong. Muhammad Speaks presented the leaders of these countries as the world's greatest men. A case in point was their portrayal of Uganda's leader, Idi Amin. The reports coming through most news media suggested that serious troubles were developing in Uganda. But Muhammad Speaks depicted the situation quite differently. According to the paper, the stories that revealed Amin to be a despot were all lies. Amin was, in fact, the greatest thing that had ever happened to Uganda and to the entire black race, and the African leaders in the surrounding countries who denounced Amin were the ones who deserved scorn. The Black Panther, on the other hand, dealt with stories concerning the economy from a class perspective and with a left-wing political outlook. The paper blamed the ruling class and the capitalist structure of the government for the conditions that affected the poor and black communities of the world. The Black Panther also addressed the issue of race differently. All the people of the world were equally a part of the human family, with a small minority responsible for most of the world's problems. The paper asserted that there was a continual struggle between the different classes of each society, and racism was a tool used to divide us to keep us weak in our struggle against the ruling class. On most every page, the stories addressed the fact that black people and poor people needed to fight against racism and work with all people engaged in struggle to gain our freedom. From the perspective of the prison administration, these notions were dangerous to the population. In the Black Panther, the international class struggle was always up front. Often, the same event or situation would be covered by both papers in wildly different ways. The death of George Jackson was a story that affected the Black Liberation Movement on the national level, while Time magazine's Man of the Year award to the President of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, had international impact for Black and African communities. Muhammad Speaks reported the death of George Jackson as simply the deranged outcome of a prison-affected mentality. In the Black Panther, however, he was a hero, while the same paper presented Sadat as a traitor of the Arab people. Of course, the Muslim paper declared Sadat a hero. Obviously, both publications were slanted, and perhaps only history will tell which was correct in relation to the well-being of the Black community. At the time, we had to provide what we thought was the best possible presentation of news for our benefit. So we began to counteract the misinformation coming from Muhammad Speaks. We continued to put our newsletter out and address the issues from a different perspective. And sure enough, it wasn't long before our newsletter became a focal point for a lively debate. The main issue centered around the reporting of news from the Black community, and even coverage by the Black media themselves. People started watching the news on the television and listening to the radio stations, most of which were white-owned. News was being passed around the penitentiary with a higher interest. Soon it was easy to find a group of prisoners standing around with both the Muslim and Panther papers open to some identical story and struggling over the issue. We were always careful to maintain the close ties we had developed among the leadership of all the groups in the pen through struggle and support of their issues as well as ours. These debates were healthy and aided many prisoners in their quest to develop an understanding of the issues that affected our community. However, we made sure that there were no serious conflicts around issues in the newspapers, because we were all Black men held in prison together under the same oppressive conditions. That was always the bottom line. And though our political differences were important, we never allowed them to become more important than our collective survival. The debates grew, and so did the newsletter. It became a newspaper. We named it The Panther Speaks, and quickly got a number of prisoners involved in its production. The paper contributed something significant to the population. For the first time, the men had a newspaper to which they could contribute their own writing. Those who had writing skills were soon submitting articles, while other prisoners acted as reporters, and still others gave up their time to type the paper up. Artists inside the prison walls drew cartoons and covers for the paper, while a crew of paper boys saw that everyone received a copy. A number of supportive individuals who saw the newspaper as their own gave whatever supplies and other materials they had to aid in the production of the paper. Its development was our response to the administration's ban of progressive publications. While we were producing our paper, another battle concerning First Amendment rights of prisoners was underway on the legal front with the help of progressive lawyers and the Legal Aid Project. We eventually won the right to receive all types of literature and reading materials in the Maryland prison system. Once we tested the court ruling by subscribing to a number of papers and finally receiving them, we discontinued the newspaper effort so that we could redirect our energy in other areas that needed attention. This decision was a result of the need to step up organizing within the prison, but it proved unfortunate for those brothers who had developed skills in newspaper production, because they had to find other outlets for their talents. At the time, there was very little communication between us and other prisoners around the country, but we felt that things were happening inside of the prisons that we needed to know about. In some cases, we knew it was just important to keep lines of communication open with individuals in other prisons who were under the constant threat of physical attack, because to lose communication with them would have been emotionally and physically dangerous. We realized that the writers could best use their skills in that area while at the same time developing new and stronger contacts with other prison groups. And indeed, the strong ties that developed between prisoners across the country would later prove very useful in national and international prison work.
This is David Engel reading Chapter 9 of Riots and Resistance. July 17, 1972. Three young boys race their bicycles down the dark alley of the 500 block of East Eager Street. A set of eyes peek at them from the window that extends below ground level. The boys, in their haste, never once looked at the 100-foot-high, ugly gray brick building. Behind the peeking eyes stand three others, hard and desperate men seeking a universal objective, freedom. Surrounding them in this ugly structure are some 1,300 prisoners going about their daily activities, unaware that their lives are about to change within the hour. The peering eyes are suddenly joined by another set as the boys speed off and race out of sight. "Let's get to moving," says a heavy voice in a very low tone. The two men work busily for the next 5 minutes, trying to remove the three bars that stand between them and the dark street only feet away. The workers are having a bad time of it, while two other prisoners wait patiently for the bars to be removed. Time continues to pass, and other people begin to notice that something is out of order. One thing after another goes wrong for the freedom seekers, because prisoners, like other oppressed people, are governed by Murphy's Law. The drill machine that the men are using blows up twice in the space of 3 minutes. This is before they are able to even put a dent in the bars. Next, they try hacksaws that work only minimally at best. The process takes too long, and the guards become aware that something is wrong in the windows. However, before they can raise the alarm, the two men who had waited so patiently, so hopefully, and now in vain, step out from the shadows and take the officers captive with their homemade knives. The die has been cast, and now other prisoners become involved in helping to capture additional guards who, though close by, were still unaware of what was happening in the West Wing. The stakes are suddenly higher, and a lot rides on getting the window bars cut before the guards in the other areas become aware of this bold attempt at liberation. To fail now is to perhaps fail forever. The outside situation is both favorable and at the same time unfavorable. A guard tower sits back behind a small white picket fence about 5 feet high and about 50 feet down the street from the window that the men are attempting to dismantle. The armaments in that tower could effectively control the whole area of Eager Street from any outside elements short of a tank. At the same time, the lighting is poor and most of the bottom of the prison is dark, and the corners could effectively allow men to move within the shadows without much detection. If the prisoners could get out the window, they would have a better than fair chance of making a successful escape into the night. The other men in the area recognized this and wanted to get in on the deal. Any number of prisoners could get away tonight, and everyone is hopeful. Some have already changed into street clothes and are hanging around watching the doors for any new guards who might foil their bid for freedom. The entire housing area has, by now, gotten word that the brothers are making a move and that there will soon be a hole in the window for anyone who wants to follow. Things begin to quiet down in the West Wing area because the men know that they cannot hold the guards for too long without the phone security alerting the central control unit. The silence would permit the men to hear if an alarm was sounded, but the absence of noise in a block containing over 250 cells and more than 500 prisoners is peculiar, and the silence soon began to work against the men. The phones near the guard station began ringing, but there was no one there to answer them. The other guards undoubtedly wanted to know why the noise level had suddenly dropped. The half-dozen men who were now working each end of the bars still hoped they could reach the streets before the guards could respond. By this point, it had become apparent that something was awry, but the guards still didn't know exactly what was happening or how they should respond to it. The next few minutes were filled with anxiety for both sides. The guards knew that they had lost control of an area of the prison and had to respond immediately, but they had to do so carefully so as not to cause a heightening of the tension, lest they risk the lives of the 8 guards now held captive. The prisoners found themselves confronted with even higher stakes because they were either going to make it out or they were going to face serious trouble because of their failure to do so. Somewhere down on the flats, a small group of prisoners were already developing a backup plan because they knew the resulting charges of kidnapping, attempted escape, and destruction of state property awaited them. Had any of the guards been hurt in the process of capture? It was unclear since they were being held in several different places and no one seemed to know precisely what was happening where. Outside, the floodlights came on and the bottom areas of the building were bathed in light. Police patrol cars raced to the penitentiary and guards ran down Eager Street armed with rifles and shotguns, as if they were in a face-off with the ugly structure itself, weapons at the ready. "Hey, you in there!" shouts a voice deepened by the bullhorn, as if uncertain what else to say or to whom it is really speaking. "Hey, you! In there!" A dozen spotlights shine into the building, providing an awkward moment in the sun for the men who are imprisoned inside. Leery of this new light, many of the prisoners who had waited in the shadows as the advance group attempted to loosen the bars that stood between them and freedom began to quickly disperse. The crowd changed quickly, as did the nature and intent of its actions. Other prisoners who were not a part of the escape attempt began to mill around the flats. They wanted a part of this new action. Among them were men who had just a little time left to serve on their sentences, which made escape a lesser option, but not liking the conditions they were living under, they were prepared to fight if a fight was coming. Other prisoners just wanted a piece of the action, something to shift their lives away from the monotony of living out year after year behind these bars. As the grouping changed, it became clear that the fight that would ensue would be more deadly than originally planned, especially as the men inside reacted toward the heavy firepower on the outside. Some of the men inside had begun to release prisoners held in the RDCC unit, an area that housed more than 500 men who were locked in their cells all day long, while they waited to be processed and shipped to other state institutions after classification. Many of these new men didn't know the rules governing prisoners, and this night had rushed into their lives out of the blue. One minute they were lying in their cells reading, writing, and talking through the doors to each other, when suddenly they found themselves in the middle of a riot. Some of these men, once they were released, began to take part in the revelry. They broke windows and smashed lights. Others began breaking into all the cabinets and lockers in their sight. It wasn't long before a few old scores were settled and some new ones created. Any semblance of order was rapidly disappearing, and no one was willing to take the reins of the riot because it hadn't begun as a protest or a direct response to an act of the oppressors. All of the prisoners' organizations had withdrawn their members from the situation early on, and a small group of opportunists took charge. Some of them wanted to hang all the guards and kill all the informants while there was still a little time left. They themselves would fight to the death, they said. Another group among the rioters wanted to release all the guards. They were saving as many guards as they could find and hiding them from the others, a courageous act given the level of violence that was now surrounding them. The cries that accompanied beatings and attacks echoed up from the RDCC area as small bands of prisoners roamed about, attacking the prisoners who looked weak or isolated. As the force of the attacks increased, prisoners who tried to defend the isolated men became subject to attack themselves. Everyone was moving around with their face concealed, and with the captive guards now unable to protect some of the prisoners, rapes and robberies were taking place every few minutes. The lights were out, the result of the men's rampage, and the entire area was pitch black. Only the areas that could be swept by the spotlight had any illumination, and when the spotlights focused on a single cell where an attack was occurring, this would stop the attack in most cases, but the lights would have to move on and search out another attack, leaving the old victim to be attacked again. While all this was happening, there were ongoing negotiations to gain the release of the guards, even though the situation in the RDCC area had dissolved into violent abandon. As gangs 10 to 15 strong roamed the tier brandishing pipes and homemade knives and feeding on the defenseless. Under the rotating glare of the spotlights, the end of the tier would reflect a little light, only to be blacked out by many forms displaying all types of weapons. As these shadowy figures walked down the tier, they would look in each and every cell, asking questions about everyone. Many of the men on RDCC knew someone who was in the prison, and in most cases, these acquaintances had already gone over into the unit and pulled their friend or family member out of harm's way. Those men who were left behind either had no ties to other prisoners or did not have anyone who cared enough about them to come to their aid. As the systematic questioning occurred, someone who knew somebody or could call the name of someone who might speak up for them might be left alone, and those who carried themselves like they were okay people might be able to avoid attack. The men who were singled out, unable to call the name of someone who might speak up for them, soon became the victim of the band who, in most cases, would assault or rape them. This was happening all over the RDCC and in some areas of the general population as well. Time was running out for those inside the prison walls, yet the angry flames of rage burned on, threatening to erupt into an inferno right in the heart of the city. The anger that fueled the prisoners was a timeless sort of fury, born of too many lifetimes of injustice and dehumanization. Unfortunately, the walls had closed in on the prisoners, and, as happens sometimes with the oppressed, they victimized the powerless among them. It seemed like an eternity, for there had been no real beginning to the riot, and neither did the end appear to be close at hand for those who were suffering. Yet it had only been 2 hours since the boys first rode past on their bicycles. Timelessness did not exist for the prison administration. They were painfully aware of every minute they did not have control of the entire prison. An attack was being prepared, and revenge hung heavy in the air. From the other side of the doors leading into the West Wing area came the sound of barking dogs and guard units preparing for the attack. Also highly visible were the police lines moving into the prison complex. The noise level grew as the police, guards, and state troopers gathered together and milled around outside the doors. Everyone knew they were merely waiting for the order to pounce, so the prisoners had erected massive barriers down on the flats made of any materials that they could lay their hands on. Perhaps as many as 100 men manned the barricades, armed with makeshift weapons of every sort. What had just minutes earlier been a chaotic situation was now shaping into a concerted effort to defend the population, when suddenly the flats were rocked by a loud explosion. The noise did not deter the several prisoners who were stationed on top of the various housing areas, which were about 25 or 30 feet apart. These men were armed with projectiles that were to be thrown down upon the invaders. Between the door and the barricades, there existed a virtual no man's land where a fight would soon take place. A series of explosions sounded as the doors flew open and about 15 dogs charged the barriers. The animals were followed closely by guards hurling gas grenades and smoke grenades at the barricades. They went off in every direction. The dogs had left the barricades and were attacking individual prisoners. The two lines, prisoner and police, came together in a pitched battle. It was short-lived. The stun guns in the hands of the police were the deciding factor in the situation. These weapons found their mark in most cases, and the victim would be forcefully carried away from the area, temporarily disabled and unable to offer any resistance. The guards moved up the tiers to lock down the prison, quickly clearing the area of prisoners. They would gain control of each level as they traveled upward. This process moved from tier to tier, with the guards stopping at each cell. They would ask who lived there and determine whether the prisoner wanted to be locked in. Those remaining people who were on the tier but not housed there would be pushed off the other end and forced to run with the rest of the fleeing individuals. The newly freed guards were now pointing out the people who had held them captive. Several of them were selecting not only the prisoners they knew to be involved, but including any other men who had given them trouble in the past, or worse, those that they thought might have been involved. The impact that this situation had on the prison was significant. A whole new set of security devices would result. Guard posts were placed in each wing, such that no one could physically reach the guards ever again. About 37 prisoners were charged for inciting the riot, the kidnap of the guards, and the resulting attacks upon prisoners from the RDCC unit. A number of other prisoners were moved to minimum security institutions as a reward for providing information to the administration before, during, or after the riot. As suddenly as it had occurred, it was over, a riot staged in the shadow of a failed attempt at freedom by a few prisoners. The lack of leadership had led to massive internal violence among the prisoners. This was much the same thing that we were seeing in black communities outside the prison walls, where many of the leaders had been removed, murdered, or locked up for the most part by the government, and replaced with imposters who had no real intent of addressing the issues that the people were facing. In the absence of the guidance and discipline of leaders who represented the best interest of the community, our youth, some of whom had internalized that same rage that all oppressed people carry around, began to turn on each other, having never been provided with any other appropriate outlet. This self-destruction is endemic among the oppressed. It demonstrates how violence, the primary tool of the oppressor, has been internalized by the victims. Had we paid attention then, we would have known that it was all a reflection of things to come. Indeed, almost all the prisoners attacked on the RDCC that night were either white or gay. The majority of their attackers turned out to be black.
This is Marty McReynolds reading Chapter 10, The Collective. Of the original membership of the Panther organization that was in place when I arrived at the penitentiary, only 25 survived the process of political education and training. We became the Maryland Penitentiary Intercommunal Survival Collective, MPISC. All of my organizing in the early years was in league with MPISC members. Although networking and building alliances both inside and outside the prison walls was always a priority, those of us in the collective who were organizing within the prison always made a point of training of our members in the martial arts whenever possible, primarily in secret. We had to constantly relocate our training areas for a number of reasons, mainly due to issues of security and secrecy. We would shift the training from area to area to keep non-collective personnel from observing our tactics and training program. On the other hand, we had to do this to keep from going on lockup, since it was illegal to train in self-defense. It was this moving around in out-of-the-way places that caused us to be in the basement of the G building one morning. We had been using the area for more than 3 weeks, at least 2 to 3 times a week. In reality, we should have changed areas at the end of the second week, but the location was ideal because someone would have to get the elevator and go down to the basement to observe the training, which greatly reduced the possibility of our being discovered. Everyone knew that the area was caged up and off limits, so no one went there. Once we got into the basement, we could send the elevator back upstairs and really get a good workout. But we had to remain there until one of the comrades brought the elevator back down. Normally, there was no need to worry about anyone, whether guards or prisoners, getting into this area, or at least that's what we thought. On this particular morning, we were working out when there was a power failure. Well, we knew that meant a problem for us, but we had no idea the amount of trouble it would cause. An electrician came down into the area by a hidden door on the other side of the building. Since we couldn't see what was actually over on that side, we could never have known that a tunnel existed there. For his part, he thought we were trying to escape, which got us all placed on lockup. The charges were eventually reduced to being out of bounds, since we were not in the tunnel area, and we really hadn't known about it. The prison officials didn't want anyone in the population to believe that there were, in fact, tunnels under the Maryland Penitentiary, so they couldn't charge us with something they denied existed. We did receive 4 months on lockup for being out of bounds, and that made our future choice of exercise areas much more selective. But it wasn't long after we got off lockup that an even more serious situation developed. Our membership soon came under attack. The only thing Bobby Mack recalled when he woke up in the hospital was seeing the ground rush up toward him and the sound of the pipe smashing into his head. He was locked up and placed in the administration segregation unit. After 30 days, he was released back into the general population. No one knew what had happened to him or why. Early the next morning, as the prisoners poured out of the West Wing on the way to their job assignments, everything seemed peaceful and quiet for the new day. I walked up the path alone and fairly relaxed. Bobby stood leaning against the railed fence. He called me, and since I knew him, I never gave the situation another thought. I did notice that he was carrying a cup in one hand and wearing a heavy jacket during rather warm weather. Beyond that, I really paid no attention to him at that point. It was only after he started talking that I realized right away that something was seriously wrong. Once you spent time in the prison setting, you start to be able to pick up on the moods of people in seconds. This brother appeared highly agitated and scared on top of that. He was saying things like, "I haven't done anything to you. Why are you planning this? And I thought we were all right." I became immediately alert and shifted to a defensive position while checking him over visually for weapons or any other materials that might be harmful to me. I was really caught off guard because here was a person that really felt threatened by me, and I was not aware of any reason that he should be. The brother seemed shaken, so I tried to put him at ease as I began to question him, asking him what he felt was going on and how he came to hold those ideas. He soon told me that someone had informed him that I had placed a hit on him and that he was to die that very day in the music room. Consequently, I learned from him that it was rumored that the first attack was supposed to have been ordered by me also. The brother had been on some type of medication down in the psychological clinic. They had fed him this story while he was medicated, in the hopes of him acting on their information without giving it a second thought. I was really getting hot about the situation, because I still saw it for what it was, an official effort to have me killed in the yard by another prisoner, without the least threat or provocation. Bobby had a long history of violence on his record, and this would just be another case. He was undergoing treatment in the psychological clinic and was not only isolated from the general population, but he was also from out of state. He was the perfect scapegoat for a murder rap. Thankfully, though, the officials had made two mistakes in their selection of him. I had actually met this brother when I was in city jail and had spent some time helping him out because he was from out of state. He was from New Jersey. I bought him a carton of cigarettes because some other prisoners had stolen his. I found out who had done this and got his smokes back. And he had always respected me as a panther and a person because I had stood up for him. He was always a little strange even then, and probably needed treatment for some form of mental illness. He had become increasingly violent over the years, and that made him a good choice to carry out the hit. But our previous history had motivated him to talk this through with me. Second, he liked the Black Panther Party, and that gave me an edge. If I had been someone else, he informed me later, I would have been attacked without a warning or second thought. Recently, one of the comrades had been attacked just like that by another outpatient from the psychological clinic. At the time, we thought it was an isolated incident. But now, a second patient was telling me that Lieutenant D took him around the corner about 30 minutes prior and warned him to be careful and watch out for me because his life was in danger. Once he understood that he was being used by the administration to attack me, he wanted to attack the lieutenant, who was at the time somewhere off at the other end of the prison, waiting to hear them call a code red. I told him that first we should confront this Lieutenant D together and see what he had to say about this before we decided on any course of action. So we went, and we confronted this pig together, and he was obviously shocked and terrified. The look on his face told us that we had caught this fish out of water. After we demanded an explanation, he told us that he had received a number of informants' notes the previous night, which said that something like this was going to happen. I had several questions. What was he doing in the prison last night, since he was a day shift officer? And why had he not offered the brother some protection? Or if he really thought the brother was in trouble, why didn't he lock me up? Finally, I asked him why he had not confronted both of us about the situation. Threats and counter-threats are made between prisoners all the time, and the correct way of dealing with them is to call both parties in and have them sign body waivers after a peace agreement has been reached. None of this happened in this case, because there just simply weren't any threats in the first place. I read Lieutenant D the Riot Act and let him know that if any more attacks or attempts were made on myself or any other member of the collective in the near future, he would personally be held responsible and treated accordingly, inside or outside or whatever the situation called for. The leadership of the collective decided to make the warden and other officials aware of the situation involving Lieutenant D, who was part of the racist clique that was working night and day to create violence among the black prisoners. Afterwards, things quieted down for a couple of months. July can be notoriously hot in Baltimore. But on this day, July 12, 1973, the weather was mild. In no way did it hint at the hell that was about to break loose. Six or seven comrades gathered in the cell that we had designated the unofficial headquarters of the Maryland Penitentiary Intercommunal Survival Collective. The back half of the fifth tier also housed our library and office, all, of course, unofficial. Housed on this level were also several of our members. It was the highest tier in the prison and the farthest away from all surveillance. We operated our survival programs, physical education classes, and martial arts training from this area. Down below on the flats, an event was beginning to play out that would have an effect on the entire prison system in Maryland. It wasn't any different from the hundreds or perhaps thousands of nearly identical events that had already occurred within that tomb. The beating of a black man was a regular thing in the history of that place. It was as if it was a required sacrifice to sustain the structure. However, this day would be different. There was a new revolutionary organization in the prison, and self-defense was a part of the platform for the group. Our organization based its principles on those of the Black Panther Party, and the members' primary concern was for the welfare of the community within the prison. I had been in the prison for over a year and a half at this point, and I had spent much of that time on lockup. So I had never seen the guards administer one of their notorious beatdowns in front of dozens of witnesses, as they were on this day. Most of the beatings that I was aware of had taken place in the hole, the isolated block of five or six cells, where punishment was meted out on a regular basis to the rebellious men within the prison's ranks. The only other prisoners allowed into that area were those responsible for serving food and performing janitorial duties. The situation. It became acceptable, and many saw it as just another part of the brutal prison culture. Guards beat prisoners with a guaranteed impunity, and this practice never even raised an eyebrow. The culture of violence that existed within this structure had direct ties to slavery and oppression, as did the culture of resistance that would soon result in a direct response to this particular abuse. The guards formed an entourage of sorts, their attendant business being to kick and beat the man that they were dragging past hundreds of prisoners. The prisoners who were on the flats or in their cells on the first and second tiers were outraged. The men began to throw objects at the guards, and those who lacked physical objects threw slurs. Each side made threats back and forth as the guards continued to brutalize their captive. When finally they threw him into lockup, satisfied that he no longer posed a threat, they went back and singled out one of the other prisoners who had protested too loudly. Suddenly, there were other guards acting as reinforcements and responding to what they took to be a riot in the making. Those prisoners targeted for retribution from the goon squad, which had started the situation in the first place, were isolated behind a locked grill. The guards allowed the other prisoners to leave the area. It was at this point that a comrade found his way up to our office and informed us of the developments below. One of those locked behind the grill, Rob Folks, was a leader in the Maryland Penitentiary Intercommunal Survival Collective. Rob was much like George Jackson, an intense brother who worked well with the population, and he was well received by most. Rob had been the most vocal among those protesting the beating, and now he refused to back down when the reinforcements attempted to neutralize the situation. A group of us had arrived on the scene at almost the same time as the original group of guards who had come back to settle with Folks and the others who had opposed the beating. One group of guards blocked the grill, while another group approached Folks, attempting to attack him from behind. Several comrades began to engage the guards who were blocking the grill, forcing it open, while the other comrades gained entrance into the area where Folks was trapped. We collided with the guards who were behind Folks, and in the violence that ensued, the guard who had been in charge of the beating that had precipitated this incident received several stab wounds. This battle continued for a few minutes longer, until finally the guards retreated, allowing the comrades to leave the area. Later, they returned to retrieve their fallen member. For a brief time, everything came to a standstill. The comrades had blended back into the population, and most of the prisoners were in that mental place where one goes after winning the battle. When this moment passed, it became clear that this minor victory would not appease the war gods. During that brief moment, the guards experienced the shock that occurs when the eye of the bully has been blackened and he is sent running. They were not accustomed to organized resistance. This was not a riot with the chaos and calamity that those situations usually bring. Neither was it a gang fight or a situation in which the guards could isolate one side or exploit the divisions. Above all, it was not what they had expected when they had made their way through the prison with a beaten man in tow. Predictably, their response would be severe. And all these years later, I am still haunted by the depravity that they exhibited. After the administration had sent for and received sufficient reinforcements, the prison was shut down and everyone was locked in their cells. Payback was in the air and on the tongues of the guards, and we knew that the collective would take a hit. Five comrades, including Folks and I, were singled out for the retributive punishment that gets served up in hefty portions in prison whenever the existing status quo is challenged, and in this case flipped on its head, if only for a moment. They rounded us up, and one by one took us to the hole where we were beaten. The area was crowded with the bodies of men who no longer looked like men. They had taken on the characteristics of pigs by this point. Greedy with revenge, it was evident that they would maul anyone who fell into the pen. I was thrown in. The attack started immediately and continued until I was no longer conscious and probably beyond. When finally I awoke, I was in great pain. My jaw and shoulder had been broken, and my head was busted. I felt as if my brain would seep out of my head as I alternated between consciousness and sleep. The bruises and lacerations that covered my entire body simply served as background pain. I have no idea of what I must have looked like at that point, but judging from the pain, it must have been monstrous. Days passed by, and I lay in pain, completely isolated and unable to identify the place that they were holding me. I did know that I had never seen this part of the prison, and later I would learn that it was the old death row section of the penitentiary, which housed the gas chamber and the cells of the condemned. They held me there in that remote section of the prison without the benefit of medical treatment for a number of days, clearly hoping I would die from the injuries. I could not communicate with the outside world, and the administration did not allow anyone into the prison to see me. Finally, my lawyer got a court order to see me, and once she saw the state I was in, she insisted that they rush me to the hospital for emergency treatment. I was there for a month, and upon release, I joined my comrades on lockup. Though the other four had also suffered through the guards' brutality, I was the only one they had tried to kill. This was the first of several attempts that they would make on my life. Eventually, the administration transferred the five of us to Patuxent, a prison that provides mental health evaluations and treatment. I guess they thought we must have been crazy, because resistance is often perceived as insane, even by people of color. The experience at Patuxent showed me firsthand how the pharmaceutical companies were using prisoners to test their new medications. I also noted that in this prison, the population of whites was more in proportion to their actual number in the state population, while the penitentiary was already beginning to show signs of a black majority. From the very inception of the Maryland Penitentiary in 1811, the incarceration rate of blacks was twice that of whites. After about 3 months at Patuxent, the Department of Corrections returned us to solitary lockup at the Maryland Penitentiary. We would spend 2.5 years on lockup. This was the first time that anyone in the prison system received more than a year's sentence at one time on lockup. Other prisoners had received more than a year's time on lockup, but only after receiving a new sentence while serving a sentence. Clearly, the powers that be were sending a message to other prisoners: revolt, and we will bury you. They had failed to kill us, so they would shove us into the recesses of the prison. In retrospect, it seemed as if they were trying to shove us back into the womb, into some form of non-existence. This is what prisons do to people of color, especially men. The design of the institution is to create a permanent state of infancy in which the individual is vulnerable and dependent. However, for those of us who had seen manhood in the absolute sense, self-determination and self-defense, there was no going back. Members of the collective continued to organize other prisoners while on lockup. We focused largely on political education and on helping many brothers to develop interpersonal communication skills. Soon, the entire lockup area was our own university and training center. Still, it is a painful existence to live as an animal, caged in a 6-by-9-foot cell for 2.5 years. Life moves fast outside the prison walls, and it is hard for the prisoner on lockup to maintain even a few close relationships. It becomes more difficult for the visitor to reach the prisoner, and the physical constraints serve as painful reminders of the prisoner's powerlessness. The pain of delivering a kiss through the phone, hands separated from touch by glass, the pain reflected through each other's eyes, all of these things remain long after the visit is over. Finally, there are fewer visits, and eventually family relationships and friendships succumb to even more layers of steel and concrete. I missed so many things during this time. It was as if the community disappeared. And after a while, I even struggled to remember what family members looked like. Finding it impossible to keep up with the people I knew, I turned to the struggles that were going on in the world and began to educate myself. During this 3-year period, I read more books than at any other period in my life. Many of these books covered Black history, philosophy, military science, and world history. Prison inadvertently provides the imprisoned with an opportunity for rebirth. I had spent most of my time up to this point dealing with conditions and being on the defensive, so this period afforded me the opportunity to reflect and broaden my world perspective, and it influenced how I would work for years to come. I learned enough to ensure that I would no longer approach the problems of oppression and white supremacy simply from a defensive stance. From this ordeal, I would become a more spiritual being, connected to the world, its people, and struggles, but sadly, less connected to my family. It is impossible to compensate for what I missed with my family. Nevertheless, upon my release from lockup, I was more prepared and determined to begin a new round of struggle. This time, I would train and educate my fellow prisoners to free themselves and our community. For the most part, the beating stopped in the penitentiary after this incident, or at least the acceptability of the brutality did. Personally, the cost was high, but the price had to be paid. There are still instances of beatings behind closed doors or in the heat of a battle, and of course, those of a retaliatory nature. But by and large, beatings would become something of the past. In place of the physical controls, they would employ new tools to manage the population. And in some cases, they were the same ones that helped to manage and control the population outside of prisons. Television, extended family visits and special events, and exposure to technology such as computers and word processors, and now even video games, help to control prisoners. All of these spread throughout the system here in Maryland.
You've been listening to Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard, read by Marty McReynolds and David Engel. Thanks for listening to this edition of this program. We'll be back next week with more readings from Marshall Eddie Conway's Martial Law. You're listening to Community Radio for Sonoma County and the World, KWTF.